Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, thus the NIDS View. It's great to be back. Of course, I'm joined by Jim Petrosky. You know, last week, hey Jim.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, audience, everybody.
You know, last week we saw, you know, Curtis was out, and we started to have a discussion about sort of nuclear myths, and you know, we didn't really get as far along in that discussion as we had hoped. So we said, hey, we're gonna have an additional discussion. We'll have episode number two on nuclear myths because it's an important topic. And so we thought we'd come back this week and we'll do it. And now, before we move on, I do want to say that we told listeners, send us your questions. And of course, we had one who sent, John from Maryland, who sent us some really great questions. And we wanted to address them. Well, John from Maryland has sent us some really good questions, and rather than try to squeeze them into this podcast, we thought next week's podcast will be actually responding, because they were great questions, so we'll respond sort of in detail to John's questions.
Adam, and we have a very intellectual audience, by the way. I just wanted to pass
on. Yeah, I mean, they were great questions, so they deserve some discussion, and they're sort of great points of departure for our discussion anyways. So that's what we're going to do next week, so you know, come back for that. Now, in continuing our discussion of sort of nuclear myths, one of the things we did not get a chance to talk about was EMP, electromagnetic pulse. And there's sort of a view that... And this is something, you know, your specialty is radiation hardened electronics, right? That's sort of what you are one of the gurus in the, you know, in the entire country for.
Are you talking to me, Adam?
Yeah, I'm talking to you, Jim.
Okay. I thought you were talking to the audience.
No, I'm talking to you, Jim. And so, you know, EMP is one of those things that everybody worries that if there is a nuclear detonation, that, you know, the entire electric grid's going to crash. And, you know, we'll go back to the Stone Age and nothing electronic will ever work. And there's just a lot of fear and concern about it. So can you sort of help us out and tell us, you know, what is myth and what is reality?
Well, yeah, and thanks. And putting the cajoling aside. So I've been studying this for many years, and I can say that there are a lot of misunderstandings. Hollywood brings that into view. I always talk about EMP, thinking of that really just incredible technical wonder called Broken Arrow movie with I can't remember the name, John Travolta.
John Travolta,
where they detonate a nuclear weapon in a cavern. I believe they shoot at it. That's a whole other issue, which we could talk about, safety issues. But they shoot at it and it explodes in a cavern and they lose all the power, which is just... silliness. Okay, so let's talk about the EMP. So first of all, when we talk about a nationwide potential for damage, I mean, there is an electromagnetic disturbance that only occurs when you have a nuclear weapon. It's at a very high altitude. Okay, and so when people say any nuclear weapon is going to take all our power grid out is absolutely false. Location matters with all nuclear weapons in a lot of aspects for many things, both, you know, the fallout for, you know, overpressure, for fires, for radiation, and for EMP, electromagnetic pulse. It's very localized near to the weapon. I mean, every nuclear weapon will produce a localized EMP in the same way that every lightning strike produces a localized electromagnetic pulse. May not know that, but it does. It's localized, and so it's very small because it's sort of a dipole. It's a dipole antenna. It drops off very quickly. And so you can think of the lightning strike to the ground as similar to an EMP. They're not the same. I'm not gonna steer our audience in the wrong direction. But a lightning strike, not the actual physical lightning hitting you, but around the lightning, you have electromagnetic disturbance. You actually hear that on a radio, especially the old AM radios. If you had a thunderstorm in the area and had an AM radio turned on, you'd hear that electromagnetic disturbance as a sort of fuzziness in the radio or a breakup in the radio. But it's not far away from the lightning, that disturbance picked up by your radio, but your radio keeps functioning. Okay, now let's move. So I just want to give that context as location and distance from the source matters. So we're talking on the ground, the electromagnetic pulse, there's something called source region EMP. It's very localized. And so that would occur, in and around the nuclear weapon. And other aspects of the nuclear weapon are much, much greater than the issue of EMP. If you're close enough for the EMP and a smaller nuclear weapon on the ground, you probably have other problems such as blast and shock and fires that would be the issue. So let's move up into the atmosphere really high. And in fact, many of our treaties, talk about, how many delivery systems and how high you can go, especially exo-atmospheric or outside of the atmosphere. Because when you get very high with a nuclear weapon, and if you get a large enough yield, you can produce, you can maximize, if you will, your EMP. We learned that from about 400 kilometers, for a nuclear weapon to cover an area of the United States. But when I say cover the area of the United States, understand that the maximum is at ground zero, just below it. And that maximum at 50 kilovolts per meter, the electric field, can be devastating. And I use my example as my cell phone. I'm holding it here for those of you on YouTube. I'm holding a cell phone. I'll cover up that little Apple thing on the back so people don't think I'm advertising anything, unless I can get royalties. But anyway, they ask, my cell phone going to work? And my answer is, it depends. It depends on many things. And these many things result in the fact that a lot of systems will survive an EMP, even at the maximum at ground zero, for many reasons. One, shielding of the electromagnetic pulse is done through metals or if you're underground, or if your phone system's turned off, okay, or it's not transmitting at the time, or it's oriented in a way that the EMP is polarized, meaning it goes in one direction and not another. So if your cell phone is oriented in the wrong direction, it doesn't pick up the full amount of the EMP. It doesn't couple. So a lot of people worry about, each individual electronic as being, will it be destroyed? Will it melt this out? For example, my generator in my house is in my metal barn. I doubt, because it's a very thick metal barn, that it's going to be harmed sitting there shut off. My generator is going to function fine. I'll pull it out of my metal barn, I'll plug it into my house, and away I go. Okay, now, most electronics, and I talk cabinet-level electronics, so you think of like a radio or a oscilloscope or some other, system that's controlling your house for heating and cooling. Those systems are built into metal boxes for the most part, and those metal boxes provide some shielding. And if they're connected to the power line when the EMP happens during that very instant that it hits, they might be damaged. There's a probability. And in fact, I think that probability is what is the problem with EMP. Will it happen? Will it not happen? We can shield to the point where we know it won't, but there's some wiggle room where things can, can break in, can get into your system and cause damage. And so it's the unknownness that's more the fear than everything. The entire world is going to be destroyed. By the way, as I said with my generator, or my cell phone, if my cell phone's sitting here turned off and turn it back on, it will function. Now, there's other problems with my cell phone. There are transmitters outside and cell phone towers and power to those. All those other things in the system need to be function as well. But not everything is so vulnerable to the EMP because of orientation, power, state of the system, where it's located, shielding, all those things matter. And so many of the systems that we have, you know, lightning protection systems, et cetera, along the outer edges of, you know, the United States. I'm sure everyone's seen that picture, that United States covered with an EMP strike, you know, and it's all covered with little circles from the EMP. If you haven't seen it, go look at any EMP magazine. The problem is, as you get further away from ground zero, it drops off dramatically. And so the outer parts are not as bad as the inner parts. Before you, I know you want to jump in here, Adam, but I will say one thing. I am a proponent, though, of dividing up our power grid in the same way as any other system. If we break our power grid up from the three primary grids we have right now to many smaller power grids, then the chances of one power grid dropping, let's say you destroy one power grid, the Eastern, the Midwestern, the Texas inner and the Western, I guess there's four, the power grids interact, they won't cause each other to fail. And that is a problem with the American, the U.S. power grid. The European, by the way, they've sort of solved that in the last couple of years because they do worry about the EMP aspects as well as other aspects such as sabotage. You know, bringing a power plant down by sabotage or a cosmic event, because you can get cosmic events that will result in an EMP. And those will cause, you know, a power fluctuation. So that's a long answer on EMP, but I like talking EMP. We can go on. Do you want to go on for 4 hours? I'll go to the very top and work myself down if you wish, Adam. It depends on what the audience can wishes to absorb. Because Maxwell's equations is really where it is. Because God said Maxwell's equations, and there was light. So we all know that it's perfect, okay? So there we go. So we can start there. What do you think, Adam?
So one of the things that I've heard here recently is that because of our modern microchips, that the wavelengths that it takes to couple and then cause the damage, that our chips are too small for that to take place. Is that accurate or is that inaccurate? That was one of those things I've heard, and I personally don't know how accurate that actually is.
So now you get a little bit more into the dynamics of the weapon or the weapon design. But I'll say, yes, when you get down to sub-nanometer size gates inside of electronics, that exactly. Coupling does not occur inside the electronic. However, now, as I look at systems and systems of systems, but the EMP can couple, and this is part of the protection methodology. If you look at the power pathways, the power pathways is not a direct connection to the gate, but it can be a direct connection to, let's say, one of the legs of a chip or a power line into a chip and driving an overcurrent or over voltage situations. So that sounds bad. But the interesting thing is modern electronics, we do that all the time. You may not know this, and I've done research with electronics where you build electronics. And if some of my students are in this audience, please send me an email saying, I remember you doing this to me. But you take an electronic device, a simple transistor, and you build it just as a transistor with nothing else. The electrostatic discharge sensitivity of that is extremely high. In other words, if you don't ground yourself and go through all kinds of the machinations to be able to get the charge off your hand from going into the system, that is the problem. And modern electronics, good electronics, all have protection built into them to be able to reduce that very quickly. They dump power somewhere else. And so there's protection measures on most modern electronics. So going back to that, I agree, Adam, on very small space, sub-nanometer, you know, 30 nanometer, 20 nanometer transistor sizes, they're probably small enough where the frequency of the EMP at its highest is probably not going to couple directly. It says indirect couples, but those are solvable problems. And for most electronics, they are, because we protect against ESD lightning and the EMP just goes along for a ride now.
So for the listeners who are not specialists in EMP,
Who's that?
Are they going to have to worry about EMP taking out their electronics? Is that a big worry? You know, is that sort of high, middle, low, you know, threat for our listeners? What do we tell them?
For a high altitude nuclear detonation, I would say it's moderate to high. It's not moderate a definite to moderate to high, but it's not a definite. The issue is the definite, because when you say, you know, I can tell you if I'm out in the open underneath a 10 kiloton nuclear weapon, 50 feet above my head that detonates and I have nothing above me, I will give it a 100% probability of killing me. Okay. If I'm in a bunker and I'm a meter or so underground and that detonation goes over my head, I have a chance of survival, a fairly good one, unless I do stupid things like jump out right away and, you know, still, you know, while the detonation's occurring or, you know, while other things are happening, like buildings are falling. But if I'm in, I look at it from that standpoint. But yeah, the EMP is not guaranteed. And there are some and very good scientists that say it's not as much of a worry as we give it context for. But I like taking a broad view because I believe that the event, because there's so unknownness on the edge, I'm a designer. I like to build electronics that are going to survive everything. So I'd like to survive everything, to include myself.
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Is that fair?
Yeah. No, that sounds good. Okay. So there's another one, and there's this fear with nuclear weapons that the ionizing radiation is going to, you know, it'll destroy the environment. You know, you can't grow food. There will be mutants everywhere. You know, probably zombies, which I mean, I'm prepared for the zombie apocalypse, but not everybody is. So, you know, we have all these concerns that will, you know, the Earth will be destroyed. We'll have to live. You know, there's a TV show, I think it's on Amazon Prime, called Fallout, where they've, you know, lived in bunkers for like 40 years.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that, and let's talk about the reality of ionizing radiation.
Well, the ionizing radiation, first of all. So let's talk about the direct ionizing radiation from the nuclear weapon versus the induced radiation that comes from the excess neutrons that come off the weapon, because there are two different problems. Okay, when a nuclear bomb goes off and the fission process occurs, it produces ionizing radiation, instantaneous production, and it continues until the fission process stops, which, depending on the weapon, we'll just say a couple microseconds afterwards. I won't get into numbers on this on this podcast, but then it's gone. So if you are exposed at that time, and you know, the bombings in Japan, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I know you call it Hiroshima, that's just who I am. But in both of those bombings, there were some deaths due to direct influence of the radiation that came off the nuclear weapon. Okay, so that nuclear radiation occurs. Some people survived it, and some people did. I'm holding again for our YouTubers. I'm not endorsing it, but I would read John Hershey's Hiroshima book. He goes into it's a nice, easy read. It's a great read because he goes into detail on multiple examples of people that survived Ground Zero outdoors. Okay, and they survived the detonation. So that instantaneous radiation, yes, it can kill you. It can injure you. It can cause effects, severe radiation effects, etc. So that's one case. The other one that is more brought out by popular culture, primarily people talk about like 200 years. Like a nuclear bomb goes off somewhere, it'll be 200 years, or I've even heard some people using, since uranium has a billion year half-life, well, it'll be a billion years because of the billion year half-life, which the one doesn't have anything to do with the other, really. In fact, I want to be around radioisotopes that have long, long, long half-lives, because if they have a long half-life, it means they're not emitting radiation. Remember, emission of radiation is just returning it back to stable. So something that has a billion year half-life means it's not radioactive. I do not want to be around something that has, especially large quantities of something that is influencing me, with like a half a second half-life. Now, the nice thing is it will kill me if I'm there for that half a second. But, you know, after half a second, only half of it's there. And if I wait a couple more, it doesn't take long till I get many decades below the threshold for death. So both of those ideas have to be coupled together in looking at nuclear radiation. So there was a historical rumor that came out after 1945 that Hiroshima would be lifeless was the exact comment put out by a fairly good source of scientists. I won't mention whom, but a fairly good source of scientists. They got together and said it would be lifeless for 75 years. But if you look at those, you know, those cities right now, they were rebuilt and flourishing very soon after, because much of the radiation, especially the fallout of radiation, is very soon changes from what are alpha or beta radiation to alpha radiation. Long-lived stuff primarily turns into alpha radiation. Alpha radiation is dangerous, especially if you inhale it. For our audience, you know, if you've probably heard of radon, radon is a natural substance in the earth. It's a gas. It's an alpha emitter. If you have an energy efficient house instead of like mine, I keep my windows open and just turn my air conditioner on as high as possible because I want to be safe. Okay. So I keep my windows open and the radon comes out of the ground, goes out of the house. But if I make it very energy efficient and hold that radon in the house, I have a chance of breathing some of that radioactive radon that occurs naturally into my lungs, and the alpha emissions will cause cancer. Okay. But that's natural. In the nuclear material, it's much more it's higher radioactivity, but it gets washed away. Okay, I've told you radon gas, but much of what is in the fallout is solid. And so what does it do? It hits the ground, it gets washed into the soil, alphas can't make it out of the soil, and they sit there until it decays to its original or some, you know, stable state and is not as bad. In fact, American scientists found, you know, very little residual radioactivity 1 month after Hiroshima bombings. In fact, that was the hard part that we had in assessing some of the issues related to the nuclear weapon, is that the radioactivity dropped so quickly we couldn't do bomb assessment because we were trying to figure out what this design that we never tested did from a radioactive standpoint. And a month afterwards, when we finally got there to measure, most of it was gone. So we couldn't even map it out well.
Wasn't that because, you know, so it's, you know, let's say it's a 15 kiloton blast, which is about what Hiroshima was. And it was at about 1,400, a little over 1,400 feet. So the fallout-free high to burst where the fireball doesn't touch the ground is, that's well above what that fallout-free high to burst is for 14.
Absolutely. It was designed that way.
Kilotons. Yeah. So, and they didn't quite know exactly where that was. So because, you know, there was no fireball that then hit the ground, sucks up stuff, irradiates it, then deposits it back down. You know, that's why we don't have, you know, a lot of radiation on the ground. And with, you know, like most of our weapons, we don't employ them. They're not planned to be employed on the ground. They're planned to be employed in the air and oftentimes at fallout free heights of burst because we don't want to turn everything into a glowing radioactive mess.
Let's get to that glowing thing. That's another myth, but we'll get to that. But you're right.
So that helps explain why Hiroshima was. And, you know, like, for example, most of the casualties were over 80% of casualties were from the fires that started because everything was made of wood. And then it just caused a large conflagration. But actual radiation burns were, you know, pretty rare. It wasn't, you know, you had to be completely outside in the open under the fire, under the, you know, at ground zero. And then you have sort of second degree, thermal burns, but then also, you know, radiation, it really didn't kill people. The, that prompt ionizing radiation wasn't really a problem. But what about, you know, what about this idea that we're going to drop all, and we're sort of dispelling this, and this idea that we're going to drop everything on the ground, we're going to turn everything, you know, into just irradiated, it's going to be a landscape of irradiated everything. You know, the buildings will glow, everything's going to be, you know, and we're all going to have Geiger counters that are just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da because everything's irradiated. True or not true?
Again, nuclear weapons, I said this in the last podcast, they will create fallout and they will create radioactivity increases localized and globally increased. I mean, we saw the result of atmospheric testing. We saw the result of ground testing. But there's a difference between an increased amount of radiation and death and destruction and plant life, et cetera, and not surviving. And I think most people get into that myth because they see other things like Chernobyl, for example. Chernobyl, yeah. Though, the radioactive inventory in Chernobyl's, you know, in Chernobyl reactor, along with not only the fuel, but all the carbon, it's what happens when you're 62, audience. Don't get there. Okay. Find some other way around it. When you begin to lose the moderator that also was there, and then the water was sprayed on it that became radioactive. And by the way, things become radioactive because of the neutrons interacting with them. Not with a, you know, if I get hit with a gamma, I don't become radioactive like it shows in that stupid TV show that was on a couple years ago. No, it has to be neutrons because they make things unstable. And if you don't understand that, listen to my NIDS knowledge. Okay, from about episode, I think, I just looked earlier, I think it was 42 or 43, where I talk about how things become radioactive. But anyway, they only become radioactive from the neutrons. But in Chernobyl, all those, that nuclear reaction was occurring, you know, with all that stuff around it became radioactive. They threw water on top of it, which lofted it into the sky. And then, of course, it spread around, and the radioactive inventory was very high. For a nuclear weapon, the whole purpose of a nuclear weapon is not to be flying around with a, you know, 17-ton nuclear reactor. You're flying around with a very small mass of fuel. You're flying a very small radioactive inventory. And as Adam said, if you detonate in the air, the only thing that becomes radioactive is the components of the weapon and the bomb debris, and most of that's vaporized, lofted in the air, and by the time it comes down to Earth, it's already decayed from being radioactive in the sky. And as I said before, radioactivity means it's going from unstable to stable. And when it goes from unstable to stable, stable nuclei aren't radioactive. Therefore, you don't have the problem. So when we think of all the nuclear weapons in all the inventories exploding in all the places they can spread, unless you were to, I mean, literally spread them around, you know, evenly around the Earth to maximize the effect, you still are not going to have enough fallout, death, you know, risk to everything on Earth. It's impossible to do that with the radioactive, even when we had, I think I told you last time, even when we had 20,000 nuclear weapons that Russia said they had, I'm sure they had many, many more because they lie all the time. But anyway, and then we had, you know, around 17,000, I believe at one time, like in the early 70s. But even if all those weapons, you could do the analysis and look at the fallout from those. Yes, there'll be deaths. Yes, people will die from fallout. That will happen. But will everything be gone? No. Will the civilization as we exist right now be gone? No. It may change who we are as a country if we do not protect ourselves because of fear, because of practice, because of preparation, because our citizens, I think our citizens, you, our audience, should be out there telling other citizens not to be afraid, but be prepared. For those in YouTube, I always like to point back here. I have some civil defense radiation detectors. If you're really fearful, and I suggest you not be, but if you want to be prepared, these civil defense detectors, people had those in almost all their homes at one time in the U.S., along with fallout shelters. And that was part of our preparation. Do we need that? Well, if I'm in a fallout shelter, first I'll survive a more possible tornado here in Ohio. Probably more chance of using it there than ever for a nuclear weapon. But survival is still pretty high, even without the fallout shelter.
So here, this leads to one of the main myths that I think, you know, we have to cover before we, you know, we're almost out of time. Oh. And that is this idea that telling kids to duck and cover was a pointless effort, that it didn't work. So Jim Petrosky, did duck and cover work?
Duck and cover is a great idea. And it's so funny when I hear people talk about it, sort of like when they talk about everything else, you know, they use words to sort of bludgeon us. But duck and cover, for those that don't know about this, lived in a hole for years, but back in
they
the
could
60s,
just be young, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You never had to duck and cover. You are quite old, Jim, so for those who are not.
I'm young. I'm probably the youngest person you know. Young at heart anyway. For those that don't know, you're right. I shouldn't talk pejoratively about our audience because they are the most intelligent audience of any podcast. But anyway, but may not be aware, during the 1960s and 1970s, when we were in the Cold War, as a way of surviving or as a civil defense measure, we had an advertising campaign that was oriented toward families and primarily children, because it's played in the schools. I remember because, you know, back in my one room schoolhouse, you know, back when we were writing on slate tablets, I still remember us doing the duck and cover exercise a couple times a year. What was it? If you see the flash from the nuclear, if the flash from the nuclear weapon happens, you duck, you get down, and you cover your head. You actually were told to get it, go against a wall, try to get yourself against the wall. And the ability to survive, not only a nuclear weapon, but again, a tornado is a good example. You know, getting down away from glass, getting against the wall with no windows, you would survive because most people, first of all, looking at the flash, by the way, that's the biggest concern that one has for a ground burst nuclear weapon is people have the bomb go off. The first thing they want to do is turn around with their cell phone and take a picture, and flash blindness is real. And if you're driving, flash blindness is really a bad problem because you're of course blind for a period of time. Okay. Enough of that. Duck and cover. When you duck, you get down below any of the blast wave that comes because a light will come before the blast wave. So there's time to duck. Okay, so you see the flash, you duck, and you cover your head because the blast wave will knock things over. But if you're near something stable and other things fall, you will survive the blast, and you will survive the effects of that blast. And that's, you know, you talk about tactical nuclear weapons. We're talking, you know, survival at, you know, less than a kilometer from a nuclear weapon. This is not the entire world dying here. This is survival in and close to a nuclear weapon, especially a tactical, you know, smaller nuclear weapon, you know, on the kiloton to, you know, couple kiloton basis.
Well, we've talked about this in the past because about 60% of the effects of a nuclear weapon are from blast and overpressure.
That's right.
And then about a quarter-ish, 30% are from thermal. And then, of course, there's, you know, that other 15-20% that are your ionizing radiation. So blast is the main thing you worry about. And, of course, getting low to the ground, covering your head is going to, you know, assist you in being safer from flying debris. So it makes perfect sense that duck and cover actually would work.
So my question for you, Adam, because you're more of a personal person. I'm an engineer. I just think of the technical stuff. You think of people. Why do you think people made fun of the duck and cover? And why do you think we don't practice this, you know, publicly as part of our civil defense measures? What do you think causes that?
Because it's the misperception about nuclear weapons effects. Because everybody seems to have this view that if a nuclear weapon goes off, everything is vaporized instantly for miles and miles around. They have a misperception of nuclear weapons effects. And when you have that misperception, of course you're going to, you know, if you're all going to die and everything's going to be completely destroyed, you know, they've seen that video from, you know, the 1950s where, you know, it's out at Nevada test site and a weapon goes off, you know, and that wood structure just gets blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they
the
assume
Apple House.
That, yeah, they assume that's exactly what happens to every building everywhere, is that that's what happens.
Yeah.
And so therefore they're like, well, then why duck and cover? But they don't realize that it's not so simple, that it matters. Like they don't, you know, how many people understand V and TK scores?
Yeah.
And understand, you know, that how the distance, you know, the yield and the height of burst and all of these things matter. What is the weather for the day? What is humidity? Is it raining? Yeah. Is it mountainous? You know, all of these things matter. And so for, you know, a schoolhouse of kids, the best thing you can do, if you were to say, hey, if there's one simple thing you can do to survive a nuclear weapon, it's duck and cover.
Duck and cover.
That gives you the best chance of having a positive outcome.
Yeah, no, and again, but we put that away because for some reason, and like you said, people think everything's going to die. Well, that defeatist view and that fear of the weapons and the misunderstanding that we pass along is a terrible way for our country to look at this situation, whatever it may be. And same from an adversary standpoint. We want them to know that we already have a plan that most of us are going to survive. So don't screw with us. I mean, that's a deterrent effect as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for those who are familiar with their deterrence theory, part of what Herman Kahn said is that part of the way we deter the Soviets is that we demonstrate to them that we intend to survive and that we know our society will survive and we're prepared for it. And he thought mm-hmm. that was a good deterrent. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, well, unfortunately, we are out of time for the episode. Hopefully the listeners have enjoyed the discussion about some of these myths. It's good to talk about it. It's, for you, the listener, some of you may be like deeply ensconced in the nuclear enterprise and you're like, yeah, I knew all that stuff. But you might have like Aunt Ada from Des Moines, Iowa, who thinks we're all going to die and she doesn't know that that's not going to happen. Maybe you should say, hey, Aunt Ada, you really need to listen to these couple of podcasts. And you'll realize that you can survive a nuclear weapon and that there's a whole lot of misinformation out there. So, share with Aunt Ada.
Yeah, that's good. I'm actually going to read you something from, not from us, but from the CDC. It's on a document I have in front of me. You can write me. It's called Myths of Radiation Communication in a Radiation Emergency. I want to read you this last two sentences because I think it really closes out well. In short, nuclear explosions are not magically unsurvivable in all cases. Knowledge and preparedness can make a life or death difference for those not instantly killed. Fair. Assuming survival is hopeless is a dangerous misconception that discourages practical safety steps. There you go. Amen. You can thank us later.
All right. Even the Centers for Disease Control says so. Yeah. There you go. What more do you need? Okay. Well, Jim, thanks. It was another great discussion. Thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us again. Of course, John from Maryland will be answering your questions next week. And if other listeners have some questions, send them in. And of course, there's one thing that we do every single week, and that is we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.